Good morning and welcome to fall. Little drizzle out there. And you made the commute.
Oh, it's great. It's great to see the rain. The river's come up a little bit.
Oh, has it already?
We did it.
Oh,
yeah.
Very cool. Merritt Perry's alongside this morning. Still interim?
Still interim.
City manager. I don't know if that means they haven't thrown you out yet.
They haven't thrown me out.
Good. It's good that the river's coming up a little bit.
Get those fish moving out of the 12th Street hole and up to where they need to be.
Yeah. Well, and just kind of, blow the gunk out. That was a Cosby thing. He was talking about a Volkswagen. Every once in a while, you just go really fast just to burn the gunk out. All right. Are you ready, sir?
I'm ready.
Why do we say that this morning? Why is a spot where a baseball pitcher warms up called a bullpen?
My guess is that they're digging with their feet and moving it around, and as they're getting ready to pitch, like a bull would in a field.
All right. Although there is a ball game called bullpen, there's every indication that the use of this term is a synonym for the spot where a relief pitcher warms did not come from that. Instead, the term came from the fact that in newspaper reporting, a pitcher whose delivery is hit hard and is often to have been said to be slaughtered. Okay. This led to comparing pitchers with bulls and the game with a bullfight. When one pitcher was hit out of the box and they sent in another, the reporters wrote, another bull was led to the slaughter. At a bullfight, there is a bullpen close to the arena where the bulls are kept waiting their turn. Thus, the place where the relief pitcher warms up, waiting to be called, is named the bullpen.
Makes a lot more sense than my guess.
Yeah. Well, no, actually, yours kind of made more sense. It would take a whole lot less time to say. Oh. So, I guess the first immediate question is, any information on your status?
I'm still the interim city manager, and I think that the council will be able to make an announcement at our meeting on December 3rd of how they plan to proceed.
So next week?
Next week.
You look calm. That's good.
Got to be calm.
So with the rain starting, I know there's a lot of, technical definition changes. Storm water versus surface water versus everything goes into the water treatment facility. Water. Okay. There's been a fair amount of dry time over the last months until the last, week, 10 days, something like that. With the surface stuff that's on the streets now starting to make its way through the system and all the gunk, whether it's pine needles. Moratorium on Monterey pines would be great. Pine needles, redwood needles, garbage, oil, whatever else may be on the streets these days. Don't need to get into that discussion yet. What does that do to the system? Do you have to ramp up? Do you have to start filtering out? Are your guys that are cleaning the gutters having to pay extra attention? What starts when the wet season really officially is with us?
You know, a few different things. One, you're exactly right. There's a lot of leaves that came down in the last week, so our crews are out there on patrol when we get the first few rains, and they're cleaning up the gutters, making sure that they're cleared, because they can overflow, and then water can get out of the gutter and do minor flooding. But that's just it. Before it even starts to rain, we go out and make sure our culverts are clean and there's no obstructions, and then cleaning off the leaves. And that's one of the things that we do on an annual basis. Just it's routine before the rains start. And you really start to see that become less of a problem once the leaves are done falling. There's not a whole lot after that. We do have an old storm drain system in the city. There's a lot of old corrugated metal pipes. It's one of the bigger challenges financially that we're facing is how do we fix our storm drain system? And so, unfortunately, in the winter lately, we've been having to repair sinkholes. We've had 2 to 3 sinkhole repairs every year. We've had material piping down into culverts. So that's a big one that we have to continue to watch during the winter.
So a lot of the sinkholes is just the metal rusting out and everything kind of settling a foot and a half?
Yeah, and it could be the bottom of the culvert where it rusts out, and then it creates a pathway for water in the ground to go, and then it takes the material into that pipe in the easiest spot for it to go, and then you you know, if it's under, usually they're under a roadway and you start to see a small depression. And lately it's been like whack-a-mole to try to keep those under control. There's, you know, there's been, again, 2 to 3, but they could be significant if they end up in somebody's backyard or on a hillside or in the middle of a busy road. And so what we're looking at for the long term is identifying the cost to do a long-term storm drain improvement project.
Dave Hull might have a little info for you on that one.
Yeah, it's a little different, though. Storm drains is tricky. It's not like water or sewer. Those are defined as utilities. So storm drains, you can't assess a fee like you could for water and sewer for a service provided. It's, you have to do more of an assessment like a 218 district. So there's, it's not as easy to fund them. You can't just set a fee as a utility. So it makes it a lot more challenging, and that's something that a lot of cities are facing is the high cost of maintenance of storm drains without, you know, getting an assessment passed to do that.
So why are they treated different? Just because it's not a special district?
State law.
Oh, that thing.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't slow down a lot of folks in Sacramento. Why should it slow down folks around here?
There's been some discussion at the League of California Cities if they can define storm drains as a utility, and I think that's something that would help. There's a lot of mandates from the Regional Water Quality Control Board right now for doing storm drain work, and of course they don't come with any funding attached. You asked about oil and trash and other things. So we have requirements now to do trash capture and have a plan to do that.
You like have a net there underneath the grate?
There's a lot of different types of practices you can take to catch those. But yeah, the simplest is probably a basket that you put in a DI. And as you can guess, this time of year, you'll collect a lot of things. It'll require a lot of time, which means a lot of money.
Yeah, and a lot of detail, paying attention to detail because you don't want problems. Etc., etc. It's 8:19.
It's sounding like Christmas all over Easy Radio 980 AM and Curry 105.3 FM. It's all your favorite Christmas music all the time. Christmas music is yours 24 hours a day on 980 AM and Curry 105.3 FM. Bing, The Carpenters, America, and more contemporary singers like Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers, Michael Bublé, and others. It's our kind of Christmas music on Easy Radio 980 AM and Curry 105.3 FM, the Christmas station. Tell your friends.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Times, 8:24. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Interim City Manager Merritt Perry. Merritt, the concept with the water, you were kind of on a roll there talking about some of the preliminary stuff in advance, but best laid plans of mice and men, right?
Yeah.
So if the mice become rats and they're a little bit bigger and the clogs are a little bit bigger and you got some drains that are kind of starting to fail a little bit, are there emergency funds that you can go to, or I know it's a concept of contingency plans, but not necessarily all the time is that money truly just sitting there?
It depends on the circumstance. We had a number of failures. I think we had 2 sinkholes and a bank failure on one of our creeks that happened as a result of the last flooding a couple years ago. And so we were able to get some disaster funds from FEMA and Cal OES to repair those. And those come after the fact. Most of our projects are small. I know the county has a huge backlog of a lot of road projects that have a lot of permitting, but our projects are kind of smaller, more discreet on city streets. We've had some near misses. We had one culvert on Jameson Creek that was old and it failed rather quickly one winter, and we weren't sure if we'd lose a whole road. We were able to stabilize that culvert and then put it in a position where it'll last for a while, but we're looking for a long-term fish-friendly replacement. But
fish-friendly, you just kind of slide that one in there, huh?
Yeah, well, it opens up funding sources. If you can find some matching funds from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, they've had a long-going fisheries restoration grant program. So we have one project where we actually designed the replacement of that culvert. So we'll have a design sitting on the shelf, and then we'll be able to go look for funding from, depending on what the sources might be.
You don't have to worry about fish restoration and whether or not it actually works. You just have to build the infrastructure so that if the fishies are wanting to come through, they could.
Yeah, we don't have to make sure they make it in there, but they have criteria that they've established. So, and they the agencies, NOAA Fisheries, Department of Fish and Wildlife, they review designs before you do projects like that. If it's an emergency basis and you have a huge failure, you just do whatever you have to do to fix it, and then they look at it after the fact, and usually you're at least replacing it in kind. So it kind of depends on the circumstances.
But you don't have to do fish counts and all that kind of stuff.
No.
Sorry to bring that one up.
I'm happy to talk about that one. When we do projects, a lot of times we have to know what's in there, and we have to do fish removal and hire biologists, and it's a pretty routine process at this point. You know, the good thing is we know what the agencies are expecting when we do a big project and we dewater a creek. It's a pretty straightforward way to avoid those impacts and the construction impacts.
Does dewater mean divert?
Divert, yeah. Okay. Usually when you're working in a creek, you'll put a pump upstream and you'll either pipe it around or you can make a small dam and run a culvert through a gravity flow system.
Kind of like doing a bridge. You have to clear the space to put the supports.
You have to clear the space.
Yeah, okay.
But along the lines of stormwater, I think that's a great example of one of the things the county's really pulled together. All of the cities up here in the county, for a portion of the county, fell under requirements for requiring municipal stormwater permits. And we pulled together and wrote one manual, so the requirements for new development were the same for Humboldt County, for Eureka, for Arcata, for Fortuna, so that any developer coming in knows, here's the stormwater information sheet you have to submit, here's the requirements you have to comply with, and they're the same across the county. So I think that's one of the things that we had done a few years back that really is working pretty well, and implementing that has gone fairly smoothly, and we haven't had too many questions.
Are there other areas where you could, to me that's called simplification.
Yeah.
Okay, others may call it coordination or limitation, but I like coordination. Are there other areas that the same could be held true? So a developer coming into the area, wherever or within the county of Humboldt, it's here's the common parts. Now, you know, you don't want to take it to the bank, but we have a lot of things in common, mm-hmm. so that you're not getting played one against the other, or they have to have a separate team of specialists depending on whether it's in Fortuna or if it's outside in the sphere of influence.
Yeah, I think when you're talking about construction and somebody wants to build something, you know, basic, each city has its standards for curb, gutter, sidewalk, and roads, and those are fairly straightforward. A lot of development standards can be different from agency to agency. If you're doing a subdivision in one place versus another place, you know, each project will have, you know, pretty similar requirements across the board, but I think
you still have the state code.
Yeah, you have to comply with Subdivision Map Act requirements and building code requirements when you're building houses. But I think a lot of that's fairly similar in each agency. And I think the one in gray area that really comes in is what are your offsite improvements going to be due to the impacts of your project. So for a single family residence, usually there's not much, but when you're building something different like a retail store or a commercial business, you know, how much traffic is going to be going off site? Does it trigger sidewalks? Those are the ones that start to get, you know, people don't want to start building things away from their property or sometimes even in front of their property because it adds a lot of expense and sometimes it might seem unnecessary. So those are the ones that you really have to look at closely and are a little more subjective. What is the impact going to be and how do you mitigate that impact? And so that's, you know, it's hard to standardize something like that across multiple agencies.
Yeah, that's where you start getting into somebody having to buy some swamp somewhere because they're filling in somewhere that gets, you know, it has a depression and gets some water for a period of time.
And that's wetland mitigation. That's more driven by the regulatory agencies.
But as an example, though.
As an example, yeah. What are we going to have to do here? And you just don't know until you get those comments back from the agencies.
Or all the reports are done.
Yeah.
KINS, News and Information Times, 8:30.
What could we do as a community to make Humboldt a better place to work and live? The answer is to make sure our kids are literate, able to plan financially, move forward in their education so they are better prepared to enter our workforce, and become contributing and productive members in our society, community, and economy. How do we do it? Through the Decade of Difference Initiative. Visit decadeofdifference.org and find out how you, as a parent, student, or business owner, can help. It's the Decade of Difference. Be part of it.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Times, 8:35. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Fortuna Interim City Manager Merritt Perry. Talk Shop presented by CDH Painting, American Ag Credit, REDEC, Murphy's Markets, and Humboldt Pest, Termite and Pest. Sorry, I was thinking about the pest. We got a couple ants this morning.
Why are you looking at me when you say
pest? Well, I can look at you when I say termite. Oh. Merritt, the sphere of influence was kind of referenced a little bit with some of the water and whatnot that we were talking about earlier in the show. You guys have got one that I guess is kind of front and center, maybe top discussed item right now, with the county saying we're gonna, right next to Fortuna, with the application or potential use being something you guys don't want. Period. End of story. No marijuana. That's pretty black and white. And in this nebulous area called sphere of influence is where the rubber's meeting the road on this one. Is there a technical term for sphere of influence?
Well, it's defined in the city's general plan, and I think it may be in the county's general plan as well. So it defines areas around cities. You're referring to the project that was on Drake Hill Road. Or across, on Drake Hill Road in Fortuna, it was Humboldt Boutique Gardens, the city. They're proposing a cannabis cultivation and production facility. And so that is in an area that's not only in the sphere of influence, but it's an area identified for annexation by the city. And that was the kind of the real rub. You know, just to get back to your comment, the city, when Prop 64 passed, it gave the city's authority to choose what they allowed and make land use decisions regarding cultivation of cannabis. And in the city, really out of the gate, they were apprehensive and they said, let's just ban it until we figured out what we want to do. And I think one of the things that we haven't done is said, okay, what will we allow and what will we not allow? I mean, we have some great businesses in the city that provide supplies. And obviously there's some things that the city, I think, would be okay with, but we haven't gone back and taken a look at that. And when I say things they'd be okay with, I think the city's primary objection is to the psychoactive drug being sold and produced in the city, but I think they would be more open to some of the things like the CBD.
So if it was CDB, it'd be okay. Yeah. THC,
yeah,
not here.
And that's where I think we need to do a better job of defining it. Would we allow things like testing laboratories or transportation? That's one of the things I think we need to have a discussion about. The appeal process that the city appealed the conditional use permit for Humboldt Boutique Gardens for the primary reason is that it was in an area that the city has identified for annexation. And our concern was that if there's a number of cannabis businesses, it's a huge area and there's a potential for a lot of, that whole area to be a big cannabis cultivation area. And I think the city has a different vision. And so it wasn't a referendum on cannabis is good or bad. It was really a land use argument that the city made is, you know, should the county be allowing these in an area that's identified for annexation? And our primary argument was that there was a community area plan done when the county updated its general plan in 1985. And there was a community advisory committee that said, there's an enumerated list. Here's the things that can happen here. And there shall not be a condition. There shall be no other conditional use permits or principally permitted uses in those areas.
And everybody signed off on it.
And it was really the county's effort to make sure their planning was consistent with the city's. But when the county updated their general plan in 2018, they attached the old community area plan from 1985, and they didn't redo that process. And I think the county's general sentiment was, well, had cannabis been legal at that time, it would have been listed in the enumerated uses. And the city disagreed. You know, and I did talk to some people who were on that community advisory committee. I said, hey, if cannabis was legal at this time and we redid this community area plan, do you think it would have accepted that and identified that as an acceptable use in that area? And they said, heck no. So it's a difference of, I think, the citizenry in Fortuna saying, you know, we don't want to see that developed for that use in this location. And if we annex it, you know, it creates problems for the future annexation, which has been identified for. And so that was our primary argument.
So if I am a county type, and we're talking, I'm going to say, okay, Merritt, annex it. Do it.
Yeah.
Start the process, and we'll hold off. Fair?
I think that's the city's only choice. It'd be crazy for the city to continue and go and appeal and put opposition up to every project that happens there and costs a lot of money and takes staff time. And so I think that's really the council's choice. Do we want to proceed with that annexation? We have identified in the city's general plan, we identified four annexation areas, and we did 3 out of 4 of those in the last 5 years. And so we were trying to make the point that we have been serious about this and we're actively pursuing these. And we've been looking at transportation studies and other things in that area in advance of an annexation. But ultimately that argument didn't carry the day. Wait. And we asked, wait, don't do any new development for cannabis now. It could conflict with the city planned uses in the future. And I think the county's under a lot of pressure to permit new cannabis cultivation projects. I think a lot of people are unhappy at how long that's taken. And so I think this is one of those instances where they said, hey, this is what we wanted with our cannabis ordinance, and this is a good spot. And
let's fast track it and get it done.
Let's fast track it.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think the city felt a responsibility. There were some informal petitions circulated by some of the homeowners, and there was a petition by 250 people in the general area around that project that signed a petition that they didn't want to see it. So I think the council really did the appeal to try to, you know, work on behalf of the citizens who lived across the street.
How long does the annexation process take? I know you have to be revenue neutral. Okay, but if there's not too many revenue generating things there right now, I would think it would be a pretty straightforward process.
I don't know that it has to be revenue neutral, but you have to identify how you're going to provide service, and whether that's water or sewer or the maintenance of the roads, the costs have to be put on the table. And so you have to do a few different studies for those annexation reports. I think one of them is a municipal service review. I can't remember what the other documentations are, but you have to look at what your plan of service is for that area and identify what the costs are and what the impacts would be. And you have to look at the land use and determine what the land use and zoning would be ahead of time. So really study it like it's going to become a part of the city and identify
everything.
Costs and impacts associated with that.
6 months?
That'd be a pretty fast process, but we did one recently for the Strongs Creek area where the new McLean Foundation building, the Gene Lucas Community Center, is being built, and I think we got that done in about 6 months. And that's a fast track for an annexation, I would say.
Well, in particular, if it's already been identified, I would think that there would have been some preliminary, at least.
There's some preliminary work, but a lot has to go into it, and it's a pretty lengthy document, and then you have to go through the process, and you have to take it to LAFCO and the local agency formation commission, which has appointees from all the government entities. And
that could be a spirited event.
Well, it's interesting. There's decisions that are made there that affect the maintenance responsibility of a city versus what's in the county. Typically, it's a city or a special district annexing some part of another. But if, you know, taking roads are a big liability. None of the local agencies have enough money.
Yeah, Tom Matson would probably be doing cartwheels on that one. So,
yeah.
You know, he'll probably be standing right behind you.
The last annexation we did in Strongs Creek, we didn't want two of the roads. And so we got we got two roads, but we didn't get a lot of the land that was identified around them. So last minute, those were thrown in on the city. So we took a big hit for liability. And that's one of the things we have to be careful of.
It's liability rather than ongoing costs.
It's ongoing in
operation, some situations.
Yeah.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 844.
Hey, Humboldt County. The folks at Fly Humboldt want to say thank you for all your support. The new Los Angeles flight is a great success. The planes have been full, so book now for your holiday travel. Don't miss getting a flight home for the holidays. And just in case you haven't heard, we'll have direct flights to Denver starting June 7th. You'll only be a couple hours away from the Mile High City whenever you want to go. This makes connecting to the world even easier. Get more information at flyhumboldt.org or email us at info@flyhumboldt.org. Happy holidays.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:48. Joining us this morning is Merritt Perry. Merritt, the concept of development, infill versus expansion, annexation, things like that. You guys have still got the big old parcel that's part of, well, it's in town. I guess it's not technically part of town since it's part of Scotia.
It's in town and part of town.
Yeah.
Owned okay. by town of Scotia.
There, yeah, okay. Just a little unfocused on that one. Any sniffs, anything going on there?
You know, we had a meeting the other day with representatives from town of Scotia, and you know, they came to the city and they're exploring what they can do to best market and sell that property. And I think that, you know, they've done a lot of good things in getting their property ready for the market in Scotia. So now they're looking at some of the other areas. And so we had what the city's doing is trying to help clarify what would have to be done for planning and to move that forward and what the uses could be.
So, progress, but just nothing to chest thump about.
I think the exciting thing is that the town of Scotia is interested in doing something there, and so is the city, and that we're going to have a good opportunity to work together.
Very cool. Well, we're not going to see you until, well, Christmas Day, so happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Weird. See everybody tomorrow.